It's on. This really connects to me.
All right, gentlemen, hopefully we're going to get the AC situation fixed sooner rather than later. Try to deal with the heat the best you can. One of the biggest lies in the English language for any speaker, and I've been guilty of this myself in more than a few of the announcements over the summer. One of the biggest lies in the English language is a sentence that begins with the words "needless to say." The only sentence in the English language that begins "needless to say" is one that ends right there. Needless to say, because it would be needless to say. If you say "needless to say" and then you finish the sentence, then there's something paradoxical within that sentence itself. What you usually mean when you say "needless to say" is that you wished or you hoped that it would be needless to say. You wished or you hoped that you didn't have to say it, but you have to say it anyway. I won't say "needless to say." I'll say what I mean, what I just described. I wish and I hope that this would not have to be the theme and the main part of the discussion, not because I'm saying it, but so many of the topics that we dealt with tonight in the entire Leliyun revolve around what we're going to talk about in the next few minutes. I wish we didn't have to speak about this. A year ago, we spoke about the phenomenon, which may or may not be overrated, but we spoke, I think, very meaningfully about how it does genuinely impact our lives. We spoke about half Shabbos. We spoke about texting on Shabbos. We spoke about half Judaism. We spoke about a whole bunch of different things. And okay, I wasn't proud that was such a burning issue, but there were fundamental things at stake, good things to talk about. 2 years ago, we spoke at length about technology. We spoke about how a person, and that was touched upon, I know, in a lot of the shiurim tonight, we spoke about how a person can maintain a particular religious perspective in the face, and we've heard this 1,000 times in the 2 years since then. And okay, that was a very important thing to talk about. To talk about the phenomenon of bullying, to talk about the social experiment, that was the subline there. I don't want to put bullying in the title, but that's what we're going to be talking about. To talk about the incredible crisis that we face as a community in the way we talk to each other and in the way we treat each other is the last thing in the world I have an interest in speaking about. It should be a given. It should be needless to say. Let's dive in moderate. What am I going to say? What is there to talk about? You shouldn't be bullying? How could it be conceivable? How could it be that needs to be said, that it needs to be described? We should be a lot more proud of ourselves than we sometimes are. For every guy here who goes to school in North America, even the guys who go to school in Israel, we know that there is a massive assimilation into Western culture. It's a reality. We know that when we look in the mirror, we struggle whether to define ourselves, Jewish Americans, American Jews, whatever country you're from, fill in the blanks. We know that we have a lot more in common with our non-Jewish or non-religious next-door neighbors in the way we spend our time and the things we care about and the colleges we want to get into and the sports teams that we follow and the TV shows that we watch and our habits online. We know we have a lot more in common with those people than we do with certainly Haredim, certainly with ultra-Orthodox, certainly with people who have a radically different way of life religiously. I may or may not wear a yarmulke when I'm out in the street, but my general identity, my general comportment has a lot more in common with a non-Jew, with the non-religious, than it does with Jews, and that's what assimilation means, and that's a problem, something we need to talk about. But when we look deeper, certainly on a communal level, when we look deeper at the way we behave as a community, there are significant, serious differences, not just in practice, not just in the fact that we have a dress code that involves a yarmulke and tzitzis, not just in the fact that we walk through streets with a lulav and esrog for 1 week out of the year, even in general behaviors and morals, there are significant differences that we can and should be proud of. I remember a conversation. There was a high school girl from Southern Jersey who was a Jewish girl, went to public school. She was involved in NCSY. And I remember her describing to me her non-Jewish friend, who was a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful girl, and her best friend her whole life. And many of her conversations about religion involved conversations that she had with this girl also. And she one time said to me, crying, tears in her eyes, actually crying, she said, I don't know what to do. My best friend, this girl, is pregnant. This girl at the time and her best friend were 15 years old. She's at the beginning of 10th grade. That is not an uncommon scenario in public schools around the United States of America. The number of people who are having relations at that age and the number of teen pregnancies, the number is maybe going slightly down, it's getting slightly down. It's an enormous problem. This is not an enormous problem. It's not sweeping things under the rug. It's not unheard of maybe, but it's incredibly rare. Incredibly rare in the Jewish community, certainly in the Orthodox community. I don't remember the last time there was a pregnancy in DRS. It has, all right, okay. It's virtually non-existent. There are issues, there are problems, there are things to discuss about relationships between guys and girls in co-ed schools and NCSY and communities. You probably don't know anybody in your young Israel who was pregnant at the age of 15. Public schools are not terrible places. There's a lot to learn from them also. Public schools in the United States of America have enormous problems with violence. I'm not referring to the isolated events like what happened in Colorado over this weekend, that tragedy. I'm not talking about specific, you know, frontline headline news of crazy isolated events. I'm talking about day-to-day metal detectors on the way in, teacher-student violence, student-student violence, angry gang fights, and that. Yeah, there are cliques and there are rivalries. We're getting a little bit closer to bullying in the hallways of MTA, JC, or ULA, but there are not that many gang fights. There aren't. There are not that many people. When's the last time somebody? And again, I'm not thinking of any specific event. So if you know of one, it's one in a million. When's the last time somebody from MTA missed a day of school, was in the hospital because of an injury inflicted by another student? It doesn't happen that often. And it does happen with some degree of regularity. We can and should be proud of that. We should be equally proud of a situation that does not exist, whereby bullying is unheard of in our community. The tone is, that should be as rare and as foreign to us as a 15-year-old needing to get an abortion, as somebody going to the hospital because they were knifed by their friend by the locker. If I told you that happened in Hank, if I told you that happened in Weinbaum, you wouldn't believe me. If I told you that there was a girl in Memphis, in the Yeshiva High School in Memphis, who was pregnant in the 9th grade, you would think I was lying. It would be the craziest thing you ever heard in your life. But if I told you that someone on the NCSY summer call-up 2 nights ago was bullied in the old dorm, you'd probably shrug your shoulders. You'd probably think that that's normal and that makes sense. I'm not here to be politically correct. I'm not here to make any friends. I am here to tell you that that is not normal and that that is not acceptable, and that when we succeed on this issue, when we succeed, and we're only going to succeed as a community on this issue, we're going to get to the point, and it's the only point we should be striving for, where it is as unheard of, as unimaginable as any of those other scenarios I said before. There are many things that we do wrong where we know we shouldn't do them, but it's easy to understand why it is that we do them. There are desires that we have, there are sins that we commit because of our bodily urges that, again, we work on, we try not to do, but we understand why sometimes we are imperfect when it comes to these things. That exists in our world. There are other things that are not based on bodily urges. They're just based on the essential human psychology, the basic human personality that causes us to do certain things. I was discussing with the TJJ guys when they were here on Sunday. One example of that would be the way we treat our parents. Few of us are perfect sons. Most of us say things and do things to our parents from time to time that we regret. We say things, we cross lines we don't need to cross. Many of us, not all of us, we got to say this, many of us don't say things to our parents that we wish we said. We're frustrated. I don't know how many people, I don't want to show of hands, it's too personal an issue. How many people on a six-week program like this one, we're away from home, have a thought, have a way that they want to relate to their parents that they are incapable of putting into practice when they're on a phone conversation or you're not back home yet or when they get back home? We have difficulty treating our parents the way that we ourselves know they deserve to be treated. You know that that's for a very good reason. You know that we are programmed and wired to treat our parents in a particular way. There is a great question that the Mefarshei Tanakh asks on the very first story of the Torah, the story of Adam and Chava in Gan Eden. In general, when we learn Tanakh, it pays to ask ourselves questions, not the kinds we're used to asking, but a little bit different. The way I like to formulate it, and some of you may have heard this from me before, an infinite God has an infinite number way of doing things. So when the infinite God chooses a finite manner in which to do something, we have to ask ourselves a question, why? What does that mean in English? When the Jewish people leave Mitzrayim, the Egyptians are chasing after them, the Jewish people are locked in by a big body of water. The infinite God has an infinite number of ways that he could save the Jewish people at this moment, starting with not having them get in trouble in the first place, continuing with, poof, snapping his fingers and having the Mitzrayim disappear, having the Mitzrayim be swallowed up into the earth like Korach was, having the Jewish people fly over the water, having the Jewish people swim under the water. The infinite God has an infinite number of ways, well beyond the number of ways that you and I can imagine right now. So why does the infinite God choose a particular finite method in doing the things he does? And by Kriyas Yam Suf, that's a very important question with very, very important answers, not for now. The infinite God could have demonstrated sin, could have given the first commandment in any number of ways. Why is the first sin that we encounter in the Torah, why is that sin the sin of the Eitz Hadas? It's a very odd sin, not one that we can relate to at all. The forbidden fruit. The forbidden fruit has all sorts of connotations in the modern day, but the actual forbidden fruit, taking a fruit off a tree that you're not supposed to take, why was that the first manifestation of sin? The Maharal explains very, very simply and very beautifully. The Maharal says because that sin was the example of all sin. And what was the example of that sin? Human beings crave independence. Human beings desire to be free. They desire to be separated. Not just the independence that I could do whatever I want, but the independence of nobody made me who I am but me. And therefore, every living creature, from you and I sitting in this room to an apple growing on a tree outside, every living creature has an automatic, innate, inborn desire to separate itself from its roots as it grows. Sin involves that independence. Sin involves taking a growing object and separating it from where it comes from. That's why we treat our parents the way that we do. That's why we have that relationship, which is so often wrong. That's why we have it, because we're programmed to separate ourselves. Of course, needless to say, that when the apple separates from a tree, it's killing itself. The apple is subjecting itself to a very, very quick and ugly death, and that's what we do when we give ourselves too much independence. That's a discussion for a different time about why mitzvos come and try to give us the commandment of kibud av v'em, that we treat our parents in a certain way, and maybe that was touched upon earlier tonight. That's why that happens. Why does bullying happen? How is it conceivable? And by the way, let's get one more thing out on the table. If you're sitting here convinced that you've never bullied a person, I'm going to make it worse before it gets better. I'm going to suggest to you in a couple of minutes that there's probably more relevance to what we're talking about now than you might think. Because there are different standards of behavior that we're going to touch upon in a minute. So you're just going to have to take a leap of faith for the next few seconds that this is relevant to all of us, certainly myself included, all of us in the room tonight. What compels a person to bully? What compels a person to mistreat another human being? Why would we do that? Why would we tolerate it? Why would we accept it as a normal part of our society? There is an incredible, what I think is one of the most important Gemaras in Shas, an incredible Gemara in Masechet Sanhedrin. Maybe some of you learned it this year. The Gemara talks about intimidation of witnesses, and there the Gemara gives the famous line. Before witnesses come in a capital case, we tell them, do you realize that the value of the life that you are about to alter forever with your testimony, the value of that life is equal to an entire world. The famous line, "Kol makayim nefesh achas ki lukiyim olam mole." If you sustain a single life, it's like you sustain an entire world. If you kill one life, it's you killed an entire world. The Gemara says it in that context. And then the Gemara asks a question. Well, the Gemara wants to know, how do we know that? And the Gemara points to that same Adam HaRishon that we were talking about a minute ago. Adam HaRishon was by himself. Adam HaRishon lived by himself, and therefore one person has the potential to equal an entire world, because historically that happened in the story of Adam HaRishon. The Gemara asked the question, why? Why did that same infinite God create a single man? God could have snapped his fingers the same way. How many trees were created at once at the time of creation? How many clouds? How many molecules in the sky? How many mountains and how many rivers? How many H2O molecules were created at one moment? Millions, billions. So why couldn't an entire world have been created at once? It would have been very easy for God to do. But God created singular man, and the Gemara answers with a number of fascinating answers. You can look it up over there. But the Gemara's question begs another question. Well, okay, once we know that God saw fit to create man individually, create man alone in the world, why did he ever create other people? You know there's an infinite amount of space in the universe. The universe, and God's universe, I mean, certainly. God did not run out of space in his creative powers. So God could have created all of us in our own giant universe without interaction with other people. The reason why we are together is necessarily the ultimate test of our humanity. The ultimate test and the ultimate fulfillment of our mission in life is going to come in the way that we interact with others. And our ultimate fulfillment is dependent on how well we utilize the power of unity and of being together. God is saying, by the very fact that he creates the entire universe and world together, that this is the ultimate testing ground of how human we are, how successful we are as people, and number two, that this is a necessary aspect of our growth and our avodah in life. We need people in order to be successful, and the way we treat people determines how successful we are going to be. That is not a reality that we're always comfortable with. We have, all too often, a different perspective on others, on our friends around us. In Pirkei Avos, the famous Mishnah says, "Kinei lecha chaver," acquire for yourself a friend. There are, if not a hundred, then dozens, there are more than 100 explanations of what those three words mean. Acquire for yourself a friend. I don't want to tell you any of those explanations. I want to tell you the worst explanation and the most wrong explanation you've ever heard and the most wrong explanation you can imagine. But unfortunately, in day-to-day life, it's an explanation that we are all too familiar with. That explanation is that kenei lecha chaver is that a friend, an acquaintance, a roommate, somebody else on your program in your high school, on your school bus, or on your block, is an object that can be treated or mistreated as we see fit. We don't just do this with our enemies. We don't just do this with people that we bully. We do this sometimes with our good friends. Our friends become commodities. Our friends become objects. Our friends become stepping stones to something else. Only when my friend is a person, only when my friend is not something that I own or that I use, but someone who I relate to on a meaningful way, only then do I have a real friend. When I misread the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, and that's how we are. I've got $20 in my pocket. I've got an iPod in my suitcase. I've got a few valuables in the safe. I've got a very, very nice watch in my drawer at home. I've got some nice paintings in the living room. And I have three friends. That's my stock portfolio. They're worth something to me. They give me a certain satisfaction. They give me a certain stature. That is the worst way in the world to have a friend. And that is a symptom of the type of bullying that we're describing. Having a friend means not just utilizing people for our good, utilizing people for our benefit. Just because it's a friend doesn't mean it's the right type of friend. I remember I may have even quoted this story last year. You know, there was a guy who was a madrich on the program for 3 years. He was past being a madrich, and he was dating very seriously, looking to get married. He had a lot of great qualities to him. He was a very sought after shidduch in that world. A lot of people were trying to set him up with a lot of people. He had no shortage of offers. He came to me with a question. He said there was a girl who he sort of knew a little bit and knew about, and it seemed to him that she was from a very superficial family and that she herself was rather shallow. He felt that there was an overemphasis on image and externals. But this young lady, I didn't even know the name, I didn't care about the name, it certainly wasn't any Lashon Hara. He didn't need to ask me if I thought that was a big deal. Yeah, that is a big deal. That's a rather serious character flaw that a person can have. He was concerned about that. But he said to me that there were so many incredible, great characteristics that this young lady possessed that he wanted to know if it was worth a shot. So I said, okay, anything's worth a shot. I didn't really understand the question. He wasn't asked. So good. He goes out. He comes back to me a couple of weeks later and he says, I'm more confused than ever. The superficiality, it seems to be there. She's very conscious of when and how people are looking at her. Her appearance, not just in making sure you're presentable, but there's just an image there that is at the forefront of what she does. She talks in the language of how are things going to be perceived, how is this going to play with my neighbors in the shul. I see that now. It's not just a rule. I see it in conversations with her. On the other hand, I've never met a person with a better resume than this young lady. She learns so much. She volunteers so much. She is so great in so many of the things that she does. And it's almost like a contradiction. And I said to him, I don't want to ruin the shidduch. I don't want to, but I did. I don't want to ruin. I said, but just know, there really isn't a contradiction. Just because something is a mitzvah, just because we're doing it the right thing, doesn't mean we're doing it the right way. If you're a superficial person, if you're image conscious, that's why you're doing it, then the fact that you're putting on tefillin doesn't magically change that. You can put on tefillin superficially. You can certainly do chesed superficially. You can do anything because of the image it projects that can be part of your image seeking. If this is fundamentally a superficial and shallow person, then the fact that they do a lot of mitzvos doesn't change that fact magically. And sadly, there are many of us, it's not really our topic for now, but there are many of us who know or even experience that ourselves. We do things because of the stature it lends us, because of the projection it offers, not because of something more real, not because of something more substantial. He's happily married to somebody else. I don't know the girl and I apologize to her, but I answered the question the way I thought it was true. The same can be true with friends. Just because it's a friend doesn't mean it's not an object. Just because I hang out with them all the time, and I'm not trying to frighten or be mean to anybody here, but just because I hang out with them all the time, just because we laugh together, just because I even do things for him from time to time, doesn't make him my friend. It might make him an object. But we have some kind of financial, we would never speak in these terms, but we have some kind of gentleman's agreement of what each does for each other because of the needs that we have for each other and the needs that we fulfill. That's not friendship. Friendship is not based on a commodity. Friendship is not a stock exchange. Friendship is based on people. When we view people as objects, then bullying becomes possible. Because if all you are is a stepping stone or a means to an end, well, some of my friends are stepping stones because of, like I said, the goodness that we give each other, and some of my friends are stepping stones because they make for an easy target, they make me popular for a joke, or because they're easy to push around. It is far, far, far worse than that. It's not only that, and here's where I said I get to the points that are relevant to everybody. There was a guy who was also an American Olet in Ramat Beit Shemesh. His name was Daryl, and Daryl is seriously socially dysfunctional. He's not in a home. He doesn't have to go to a special camp or anything like that. He's a single guy who is socially awkward, to say the least. He is extremely talented at saying exactly the wrong thing at all the right times. He does not pick up on social cues ever. He doesn't have a lot of good friends. He doesn't have a great life, quite honestly. But that's his lot in life. So there was one Simchas Torah when we were dancing around Hakafos, and Daryl, this is what he doesn't have a great voice, but he thinks he does. Daryl, wrapped the talus around himself. He stood up on like three chairs and he started belting out, one of those hakafos ones that fled it, whether it was tzave or whichever one it was. And he started, it wasn't even the right hakafa. Wasn't the right time, it wasn't anything. His voice was off key. He was mangling half of the words and he didn't know the tune. It was really tremendously embarrassing for Daryl. And there were more than a few people, with the help of alcohol or not, more than a few people who were snickering, laughing, pointing fingers, jeering at Daryl. Daryl brought this upon himself, but there were people who were giving him a really rough time for it. Daryl this and Daryl that, or just laughing behind Daryl's back at Daryl's expense. Now, I thought that that was really, really wrong. I'm a good guy. I couldn't imagine people doing that to poor Daryl. So I did an old trick because it was pretty funny, because Daryl was making a spectacle of himself. But I knew, I felt in my heart, because I'm a wonderful person, I knew in my heart that laughing at Daryl was going to be wrong. So I started biting my lip. When that wasn't working, or I began to draw blood and violating halacha, I tried to hurt myself in other ways. When that's very hard to hurt yourself, you know? So then I had to think about really, really sad thought, you know, say, I tried to imagine all the people that I didn't want to die and how'd I feel if they did. I had to start getting very creative, you know, to keep myself from laughing. And ultimately, I turned away. And I turned away, I was filled with such pride, such a holier-than-thou feeling about what a great person I was and what a great big tzaddik I was. I mean, that's the way you're supposed to act. And again, nobody, I didn't think anybody was watching me, but for myself, that's why they pay me the big bucks. That's what a good person does. And there was somebody else there who reacted in a completely different way that humbled me so much. And that showed me the difference, like I said, how bullying could be a part of everyone's life, even though it shouldn't be, and how much we have to be careful about. I'll tell you, make it into a riddle. You'll think for a minute about what that's not that hard to do, especially when you have the ability to sit here. It's not happening in real time. I'll tell you in a minute what that guy did. I'm going to tell you what a different guy did once. I'm going to tell you a Torah from the great Rabbi Benjamin Yudin, his son Gotch, Rabbi Gotch Yudin, the Sano Yudin from Morashah, now from a wonderful new school called Ashreinu in Beit Shemesh. Rabbi Yudin Sr. from Fairlawn, New Jersey. Rabbi Ari Yudin from Dieras, his dad. Our Rabbi Anta Yudin, his dad. They're all brothers, and their dad is a very, very great man, Rabbi Benjamin Yudin in Fairlawn, New Jersey. You know, there's a parsha in the Torah that talks about the Eved Ivri. In the beginning of Parshas Mishpatim, there are a few psukim in the Torah that talk about the Eved Ivri. The Eved Ivri is the Jewish slave. It's a fascinating discussion for a different time about how there could be such thing as a Jewish slave. Okay, there's such a thing as a Jewish slave. There's some beautiful laws about how we're supposed to treat the Jewish slave. Okay, fine. Such a thing exists also. How do you become a Jewish slave? Well, there are two ways you become a Jewish slave. One is if you default on a loan, and one is if you steal from a person and you can't repay it. Now, on a certain level, that makes a little bit of sense. Imagine you have a restaurant, and you walk out to the front of the restaurant one day, and you find the guy in your restaurant with his hand in the cookie jar. The guy doesn't have what to eat, he doesn't have a lot of money, and he's stealing food from your restaurant. So please put him in handcuffs, and the guy says, hey, you owe me for the steaks you just ate. You owe me for the cookies, the bagels you just took. And the guy says, if I had money to pay for the bagels, believe me, I would. I don't have a dime to my name. So the policeman says, all right, you have any jobs to do? He'll work it off. He'll wash dishes until he's compensated you for the bagels that he took. Okay, sounds fair. Play that out in a private home. I go to sleep one night. My wife and I, we're in the house. It's dark in the house. We hear some rustling downstairs. She nudges me, go check it out, okay? I'm a big, brave guy. I'll go check it out. Go down, and lo and behold, there is a thief there. Well, in our hypothetical, I jump him, give him a few whacks. All is good in the world. I subdue him. There is a guy. He's got a bag over his shoulder. He's now on the floor. The bag is full with candlesticks, electronics, thousands, millions of dollars worth of merchandise that he's taken from my house. All of this is, he does, and the police are carting him. I go upstairs, proud of myself. I tell my wife what happened. Yeah, you're right, the rustling was a burglar. I took care of him, no problem. He's not going to mess with us again. By the way, he is coming to live with us, though. If you get the guest room together, he's going to be moving into our basement. Because he owes, he's got to make good on that. Obviously, in my scenario, he didn't make away with it. But again, fill in the blanks yourself. He has to make good on what he owes us. This guy who just broke into our house, he's going to be living with us for the next few weeks. It's a very, very strange. Who would want that? What does that mean? Explains Rabbi Yudin, listen very carefully. Explains Rabbi Yudin, you know what that would mean? You know what that is? The Torah is telling you, this is not what you get if somebody breaks into your house and steals stuff. This is your obligation to society. This is the heroism. I'm going to come back to that word in a minute. This is the heroism that the Torah demands of us. What the Torah expects of you and I as people who follow a certain moral code. A guy breaks into your house, he threatens you, he threatens your family, he violates your property. You know what you should be thinking? Thanks for a guy to do that. I bet he needs a warm bed. I bet he needs a place to stay. I bet he needs to see what my Shabbos table looks like. I bet he needs support of a family. I bet he needs a place to go. Do you know how what a prince of an individual you have to be to hit that madriga, to hit that level of what the Torah is describing to us? Well, Rabbi Yudin said this Torah, and Rabbi Yudin lives this Torah. When I was at an NCSY Shabbaton once, sounds like a made-up story, but it's 100% true. So at an NCSY Shabbaton was in Fairlawn, New Jersey, Rabbi Yudin Shul. There were a bunch of boys who had never had a Shabbos before who were at that Shabbaton. In general, in NCSY, they're not that machbid at Shabbaton. It's about Mayim Acharonim. But at this Shabbaton, Rabbi Yudin's house is right across the street from the shul. So there's some people close to Rabbi Yudin who, when it came time to bench, ran to Rabbi Yudin's house to get his Mayim Acharonim silver cup so that he could watch Mayim Acharonim at the table. Not the whole Shabbaton. Rabbi Yudin, of course, was not sitting at a VIP table because he never has done that one day in his life. Rabbi Yudin was sitting at a table with the five guys who was there for a Shabbaton. And Rabbi Yudin was not going to take the Mayim Acharonim cup first. So he made a slight error, forgetting that they probably didn't know about Mayim Acharonim. He motioned that they should go first. The guys who was their first Shabbaton ever were a little bit confused. Here's a little espresso cup filled with water. It's very, very weak stuff. But when in Rome, who knows what the Jews do? Do what the Romans do. So he holds up the cup, he says, L'chaim, and he drinks it. Bite the lip. Try not to laugh. Try not to embarrass the guy. Or if you're Rabbi Yudin, jump up at the table, pour another cup of water, and say L'chaim right back at you, and drink it down. That's what Rabbi Yudin did. Because when you're not just saying Divrei Torah, when you're living Divrei Torah, when you view a guy who breaks into your house as an opportunity of a human being that you can help, as opposed to a person who owes you something, the entire world looks different to you. People look different to you. You know what that guy did to Daryl instead I didn't do? You know why I'm very, very low on the totem pole of good behavior and the real heroes? What does a real hero do in that situation? The real hero got three chairs. He stood up right next to Daryl, put his arm around him, and off key with the wrong tune, started belting out the niggin with him and got everybody working with Daryl right in the middle. I don't know too many people who are capable of doing that, but that's what we're meant to aspire to. Bullying? Are we out of our mind? You know what bullying is? Listen carefully to the next sentence. Bullying is paraphrased, really defined, as an abuse of power. I'm in a room and there is a dynamic. I have power. Because I'm popular, because I'm witty, because I have friends, because I have position, because I have territorial rights, whatever it is that allows me to bully, I have power. You know what the Torah says to us? When you have power, wisdom, a house, wealth, a personality, use it to make something good, not to ruin something, not to break something down. Bullying is, I'm not here to tell you don't bully. I'm here to tell you bullying is an abuse of power, and instead of abuse of power, there's use of power. Every single time you and I open up our mouths, we have the ability to build and create or to wreck and destroy. That is the power of our words. We have to use them carefully. I'll give you an amazing, I love this example. It's one of my favorite examples in the world. You have, not bullying, I refuse to lower ourselves to talk about bullying. I'm talking around bullying. You have a few guys who are sitting in the room and one guy's losing his temper. He's getting really, really stressed out. So you say, I think I may have mentioned this one even at the DRS Shabbaton. But you say to the guy, he's getting really stressed out. So you put your arm on him and say, hey, calm down. You know in the history of the world, no one has ever calmed down when they were told to calm down? I'm telling you, this is a stat. In the history of the entire world, no one has ever calmed down. Nothing infuriates a person and raises blood pressure like being told to calm down. Do an experiment. Go to a madrich, and specifically a madrich. Go to a madrich who is sitting peacefully drinking a slushy out on the porch outside with a blood pressure that is barely registering and tell him to calm down. Watch how quickly he gets upset. Watch how quickly he loses. That's the effect of telling a person to calm down. Every situation, there are key words like that. There are words in a room, I'm not the bully, but there are words, there's a dynamic in the room where I can use my power. I can use my influence to change the dynamic of the room. There are certain key words, certain gestures, certain things that I can do that can make the room better, that can change the subject quickly when it's veering into a place that it's not supposed to go, that can, I don't have to give divrei Torah to do this, that can elevate every person in the room. And there are also words, even if I'm not the bully, there are also words, there are also responses. There's a laughter, there's a gesture, there's a body language that can exacerbate a situation as bad, if not worse, than the worst bully is in the room. Yes, bullying is an abuse of power. Yes, we have power. So God says to us, if I'm going to give you power, use it. Use it to build. Use it to be right. Use it to be good. That's what we're supposed to do. Not abusing power, but using it in the proper way. And this defines us as human beings. This is the greatest to be able to say, I went on the NCSY Summer Kollel, and the people that were near me were better for the interaction. The people that were near me were elevated because of their connection to me. Because of the way I behaved, because of the way I spoke to them. My friends, and by the way, you don't have to be some kind of you know, non-confrontational, soft and sweet. Well, we're not talking about that. That's why sports on the Kollel, by the way, are so important. People say, and they're right, sports are competitive. I want very badly to beat you. I want to do that. Hit you first. Here, please, score. It's not the way you play ball. That's not the way it's supposed to be. That's not respect for your opponent. That's not respect for your friend. Chavrusas, like Rasabulovsky spoke about, before the Siyam HaShas, chavrusas are meant to challenge, to yell at each other, to work on each other, but out of love and out of respect. Rasoloveitchik with his students, the way he would give shir, making sure that every letter and every word was perfect, challenging. That's part of respect also, is challenging when they're wrong. Is we're not supposed to be soft and be pushovers. We're not supposed to let anything go. We're supposed to believe in something. We're supposed to stand for something. But we're supposed to do it in respect. There is no reason in the world why we should ever deny or be in the dark about how much we depend on each other. And how much our final report card, our final din b'cheshbon, will revolve around this question. Imagine a guy, and it surely is not Asher Becker. Imagine a guy who finishes Shas a dozen times. A guy who spends his money that he earned as a lawyer building hospitals and Torah institutions. And in his final din v'cheshbon, the prosecuting attorney presents one person to whose life was shattered, whose experience on a summer program where he could have grown was miserable because this guy was just quiet in the room while abuse or bullying was taking place. Show me a person who has all the greatest characteristics in the world. He's funny and he's cool. He's smart and he's diligent. He hasn't missed a minute. He hasn't missed a shakas. But he's a jerk in the dorm. I'll show you a jerk in the dorm who learns a lot. It's not a guy who learns a lot who's got a weakness in the dorm. He's fundamentally a jerk who happens to learn a lot. There's no badge of honor in being that person. We need to set the standard. We need to start tonight and we need to start here. We need to start the standard that, as absurd as it would be for any of the other cultural problems that exist in the world to seep into our yeshiva system. Yeah, there are a lot of people smoking all sorts of things in yeshivas. There are not a lot of hard drugs, and there are not a lot of gang fights, and there are not a lot of teenage pregnancies. We should be able to say in a couple of months, I've never heard a negative bullying word in MTA. I've never seen in Frisch a guy abusing his power to make another person's life. It would be unheard of. I can't imagine such a thing. And that's going to be our final report card and scorecard for this summer and beyond. It's Davin Marv. Have a great night.
Is this recording? So you can hear what I'm saying?
Oh, that was a wrong
thing. Is that recording? So my voice is going on this? How about this? Is my voice going on? You can hear me now. You can hear me. Help! I'm trapped in a phone. And I'm a corner. Help!
Help! I'm trapped in a phone! And let me out!
Yeah. I think technology is awesome, by the way.
Help! I'm trapped in a phone!
I would kill the air chainsaw.
We all know the truth. We're not really listening to that.